The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's MadTech Podcast, bringing you the latest in media, marketing and commerce. For this week's edition, I'm delighted to be joined by regular guest, Lindsay Rountree. Lindsay, welcome.
Hello. I'm very regular. I think I feel like I'm too regular at the moment, but it's always good to be here. I do love doing this.
You are on frequently, but you are a trusted voice in the industry, so always good to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Our special guest for this week is Rhys McLachlan, Director of Advanced Advertising at ITV. Rhys, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. A face for podcasts.
That probably applies to everyone in this room.
Three of us. Excellent. We'll crack on. We've got some interesting stories this week, and we'll start with AI, which is obviously one of the hot topics of the moment. But News Corp is going to sue Perplexity. The subsidiaries of News Corp, Dow Jones and New York Post Holdings are suing generative AI platform Perplexity over the alleged use of its copyrighted material. The lawsuit alleges that Perplexity has comprehensively scraped News Corp's publications without permission and then presents the output such as full article text without remuneration. This is going to run, I think. We've had a lot of discussion this year about the relationship between the AI platforms and publishers. Rhys, do you think News Corp getting involved can be a bit of a tipping point in this discussion between AI and publishers?
Is this the same News Corp that in May of this year announced a major partnership with OpenAI?
That'll be the one.
So what do we think the origins of this lawsuit are exactly? Is it the fact that they've chosen their weapon, they've chosen their frenemy, so to speak, and are endeavouring to kind of shut down access for the other AI platforms that are out there scraping the internet at a rate of knots to build out their databases for artificial learning? I don't think this is a moment. I don't even think this is a marker. I think this is all commercial. I think this is all positioning and posturing.
Yeah, interesting. Lindsay, how do you feel about that?
I mean, I'm really enjoying Rhys's cynicism, and I feel like it's going to be the golden thread throughout this podcast will be just Rhys being cynical about everything, which is just brilliant. I do think that, my first thought was, well, hang on, haven't Perplexity just announced they are doing deals with publishers and they're going to do rev share with them? So why have News Corp chosen to continue with suing them when they are part of the deal? And of course, it's, you know, the fact that they already have a deal in place of OpenAI does, you know, make one raise one's eyebrows slightly and kind of go, okay, well, there's clearly something going on here, because Perplexity, I think Perplexity were announcing and looking into publisher rev share deals before OpenAI even did. So it is very, very interesting. This is the route they've gone down. And there's going to be more of this kind of back and forth. And I think that as long as these OpenAI platforms keep doing this with publishers, and as long as publishers keep, you know, creating deals with them, you know, there's deals all over the show, even, you know, what Reddit are doing with Google and everything else. Like there's going to be deals everywhere. That what's lacking throughout this is consistency and standardization when it comes to probably more on the regulation side of things. I mean, I don't know what that's going to look like, because it's a bit like we talked about the CPCA thing last week with trying to kind of bring standardization to GDPR interpretation for both big and small tech players. That's great in the UK. What about the rest of Europe that has similar laws in place? As long as one market has a rule around what's going to happen with AI and how AI has to play with publishers and play fairly and nicely with publishers, if that applies to one market but not the other, we're never going to get anywhere, and this kind of stuff will just keep on going, is the way I see it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. It's that absence of governance, isn't it? It's a real wild west. And what's really interesting about what's developed in this space across the course of the last 18, 24 months is, in the absence of any regulation, in the absence of any material governance, bad acting happens, right? These entities, these businesses, these initiatives just cannot help themselves. If there is an absence of swim lane, they'll swim everywhere.
Yeah,
and I think that's it's fascinating, isn't it? If there are no rules or regulations that I need to abide by, then damn it, I'm going everywhere and I'm doing everything. And it's interesting that the publishers are starting to coalesce around a set of standards, I guess, for the engagement with these entities, because there's an inevitability that they are going to become a major and material part of the open internet. But publishers, more often than not, do have some heft, even though in a modern digital world it's been much eroded over the course of the last 20 years since the evolution of the modern internet, modern web. at a kind of gross level, big publishers, entities like News Corp can behave in a draconian way and look to shut things down and litigate to get what they need. But independent creatives, independent publishers, small enterprises, boutiques are much more exposed in this space. And you know, I note that earlier this week, a whistleblower out of OpenAI, I think it was, said, yeah, without a doubt, that entity has been operating with due disregard for copyright laws in all jurisdiction. And I think it was yesterday, an open letter was published from 10,500 creators, you know, Tom York, Julian Moore, and other luminaries in the entertainment world, saying, we seem to have no rights. We don't have, seem to have a voice at the table. And I think that should concern us all. A vibrant creative industry, a media industry, needs voices from a diverse set of places and a diverse set of voices. And if those entities aren't adequately represented in the engagement with the open AI, with the AI businesses, then what are we going to be left with? And who owns the genesis of the idea? Who owns the voice?
That's a really good point. I think as well, like based on what you were just saying, Reese, I think also there's this potential concern and fear around the fact that, well, okay, if these big players, you know, like News Corp, even Mumsnet, which is an independent player, but even, you know, even they're going down the suing route as well. If they've got the clout to be able to do that, it falls on the mid to long tail publishers that are going to lose out here, because firstly they can't afford to sue, and secondly they probably won't get the same impact, they probably won't get the same rev share agreements that these big players will get.
It's brilliant though, isn't it? This is like a kind of reverse Russian dolls scenario where like you asked me 10 or 15 years ago, News Corp was the evil empire, right? You know, colloquially known as, you know, the Death Star.
Yeah, totally.
And now there are bigger and bigger and bigger, like ever increasing, what is it, you know, the whales eating sharks, eating killer whales, eating squids, or I don't know, I'm riffing now. But there's the businesses which were, you know, the large corporations who were the you know, the vampire squids, are now themselves being vampire squidded by bigger plays. I think that in and of itself is testament to how fast this industry and this ecosystem is moving at the moment.
We all wish plucky underdog News Corp good luck in.
Well, you know,
plucky underdog. Yeah. Oh yeah, they'll love being called that.
The other thing, if I may, on this story before we move on, like, and I don't mean to be glib about it, but AI, right, right, artificially inflated. Right, is that what it stands for? Like, look, I know it's going to be important, and I know that it's going to be something that we are going to have to engage in for our respective employers and the industries that we work in. But what I've seen to date, and we're very active in this space at ITV, but what I've seen to date is the presentation of it, if you like, is wafer thin. Because when you get into the nuts of it, when you get into the weeds of it, it leaves you wanting a lot more substance than what it's currently generating. I said, I'm not being disingenuous. You know, we've used it to create ads, and those ads have been relatively successful. We're using it to stimulate and generate programming and commissioning ideas, not the actual programs themselves, but to stimulate and explore possibilities around commissioning. But in many fields across, you know, ITV is a very big business operating across a number of fields, and AI is not going to materially reshape our business in the next 18, 24 months. I would even argue, and this is my view, not necessarily the view of the PLC, that I don't think we'll see major impacts being made by AI for the next 5 years. And I will stress again, that is my view based on where I sit in the organisation.
Yeah, sure. Lindsay, any thoughts on that?
I was going to say, it's so interesting because I think that there is lots of... Obviously, you just said that, you know, you guys have been using it for ad creation and it's been successful, and obviously you're using it to kind of help generate ideas. And I guess, you know, as a kind of seed, it does have a value and have a role. But if it weren't there, would that fundamentally have made any of your jobs or any of your lives worse, or made the functioning of your business any more difficult than say 2 years ago when you had to do all those things yourself anyway? And there's also the element of there needs to be human input in this, and not even needs to be, there does need to be, but also people want to have human input into this. Like, there will be I'm sure there will be kind of like, you know, the kind of independent broadcasters that will do everything via AI come, you know, I was going to say 5 years down the line, probably even next year. Every single thing they do from the conception, the inception to the creation to the publishing will all be done by AI. And I think you'll be able to tell the difference. I don't even think you will be able to tell the difference. Like, it will be obvious to you that this has all been AI generated versus where there is still the element of human control.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. The importance of human critical faculties will only increase. So AI, it's... what language are we allowed to use on the podcast?
Whatever you like.
Right, it's a shit-in, shit-out model, right? And so if your inputs aren't good and highly qualified and very accurate, then your outputs aren't going to be very good either. And so if anything... the proper harnessing and deployment of AI is going to require a greater set of manual oversight than what many people think it will otherwise require. So the inputs need to be accurate, and the critical faculties in evaluating, assessing and adjusting or recalibrating the outputs are going to be important. What I've seen today, I would describe it, what's generally I see as a civilian, if you like, on AI, is it's like listening... for the older listeners of the podcast, it's like listening to a radio station that's just slightly off channel. There's a fuzz around the edges. You get most of it and you can kind of comprehend it, but there's just a little fuzz around the channel. You're just aware of it. And that's just, I think that's just human nature. And yeah. So until such point you've got proper human oversight in the outputs of AI, you're always going to have that fuzz around the edges. People just know.
That's so true.
We innately know.
We do. Yeah. If something feels off about
it. Just off enough.
Yeah. You saying that made me think of I was chatting to a friend recently who works in PR in a completely different industry, and he was trying to get create this PR for this company that had just launched something. And he was like, well, I tried using ChatGPT, but it's actually really rubbish because I put in the detail, can you create a press release on this company? But it hadn't even heard of the company. It had no detail on the company. So it just didn't produce it. So I went over doing that again. And I was like, you need to actually give it the detail of the company and it'll then write it for you. Like, okay, I mean, I think that there's no need, if that's the caliber of people trying to use it and trying to get output from generative AI, I think we're all right for a bit.
I think we're all right. That's precise. I think we're going to be okay for a while. I also, it amuses me, these really clumsy efforts of these businesses to create, to initiate the machine learning as well. I think I've been amused, bemused, and somewhat irritated at various points, depending on what time of the day it is, around... I'm sure you guys get it as well. The LinkedIn, you're a chosen expert who's been, requested to answer this problem. Like, sure, yeah, sure.
I'm the chosen expert.
You're like, you are just trying to build your database. So at some point, LinkedIn, is going to build out this massive problem, business problem solving AI engine, which is a combination of all our answers, isn't it?
So, but the problem is, you'll be there going, come on, LinkedIn, how dumb do you think I am? For every one of you, there'll be 1,000 more that will go, oh, wow, I'm chosen. Thanks so much.
No, I just see this as well. And these are people I've worked with or so-called experts in the industry. You're like, come on. You know what's going on here.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I mean, AI has also allowed people to flood LinkedIn with identikit posts of thought leadership or, positive messaging or untrue stories.
I come back again to the point that I made. I did a very serious point in the absence of well-established guidance, governance, regulation. This is a force for bad for society. The extent to which AI, both generative and ChatGPT, has been weaponized in the US election should concern us all.
Absolutely.
And some very instrumental and influential people who will help shape the outcome of that election are actively and knowingly promoting AI-generated content to sway the outcome of that election to their favored candidate. I've seen some pretty worrying things happening, especially in my Twitter feed. It's a bit of an echo chamber, but you see some bad stuff happening there. And AI is very much being weaponized as a force for malfeasance, and that should concern us all. And I'm not a big fan of regulation either. I work in advertising. God, I'm a free market, kind of guy. Yeah. But in the absence of regulation, bad forces prevail. and the weaponization of new technologies and new solutions to pursue ends which are not necessarily democratic or liberally orientated should concern us all. Soapbox.
Yeah, no, I think that's...
Soapbox, definitely.
but all very valuable. And yeah, like you said, Reece, you know, when the guardrails are off, people don't stay in the lane. They'll go everywhere. They will take whatever they can. So yeah, this might once again be a case of the gate being closed after the horse is bolted.
It's that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And this is the problem. And we see this with, you know, what, you go back to my reverse Russian dolls analogy, you know, the European regulators and the Justice Department in the US trying to retrofit regulation to the big tech giants. Yeah. You know, we're going to have that 2.0 trying to retrofit regulation for a set of AI entities that will have already surpassed or gone past, you know, would have moved on. Everything's retrofitted.
Yeah, well, we'll all await US DOJ versus OpenAI in 2052 when that.
It's like the Google antitrust at the moment, is it? The only people who win in these scenarios is the lawyers. We all choose our careers badly. We should have been media lawyers or regulatory lawyers, because it's just going to roll on and on and on, isn't it? And nothing material is going to happen as a consequence. And that's not me being cynical. I think that's very much an honest appraisal of the situation.
Cool. Right. I will move us on to our second story, which is a new tool has been launched to help promote brand unsafe inventory. Independent media agency Bountiful Cow has announced the launch of a programmatic tool designed to buy quality inventory previously classified as brand unsafe. The tool, called Relative Advantage Unblocked, was developed in partnership with the publisher alliance Ozone and was built to solve for occurrences where brand safety technology penalises quality publishers by overzealously blocking their content. Lindsay, I'll start with you. Do you think brand safety precautions are currently overzealous? What do you think of this move?
I mean, they definitely are. And the fact that this thing even exists just tells us what... I'm fascinated by this. I think it's on the face of it, it's a really good idea, because it's trying to prove a point that actually there's lots of premium content out there being classed as brand unsafe when it absolutely is not. And there's a lot of work needs to be done here. But the fact that we're in a situation where an independent agency, what Bountiful Cow are doing, I'm all for it, but I'm also not for the fact that we've got to this place in the first place. Like, the fact that we have to buy brand unsafe inventory and to prove a point, and they've got a research partner, I think it's Hilltop Honey they're launching with, to be able to prove that actually this stuff is not brand unsafe, but it shouldn't be classed brand unsafe in the first place. And we've touched about this on many a podcast episode. If we were in a non-advertising world and there were a bunch of restaurants that had all been labelled as unsanitary, but the mechanisms to label them as such were not genuine and had been done poorly, and then somebody else came and said, right, I'm going to create an app that actually tries to prove that all these labelled unsanitary restaurants are actually fine to eat at and everyone's like eating at them, you know, what kind of, we'd all be like, sorry, what? But they've been labelled as unsanitary, so why are you going to eat at them? Why would you bother actively trying to promote that? That is what is happening here. We're trying to, it's like a hack upon a hack upon a hack to be able to prove a point, when actually we should just be in a position where we can effectively and accurately label content as safe or unsafe using logical methodology. But we've entered into this world where everyone just keeps adding layers of things on top that keep saying what's safe or unsafe, that we've entered into a world where people happen to actually buy what's been labelled as unsafe inventory and be able to, and to have to partner with Ozone to do so, to prove a point. It just makes no sense to me. I understand why they've had to do it, but we shouldn't be in this situation in the first place.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, and firstly, you know, well done to the cowboys and cowgirls over at Bountiful Cow for leading on this. And the work that Ozone have been doing the last 4 or 5 years in this space has been laudable. And it's great that they're carrying the torch here. There's a couple of points I think that are worth unpacking, picking up on yours, Lindsay, which is who's allocating gatekeeper status to these verification businesses? And I think the extent to which they have spiraled into positions of real undue influence should worry us all. The second point is that, you know, we are a big producer of news. ITV is in the news business, and quality independent journalism is the bedrock of a functioning democracy. And the extent to which news has been demonetized as a consequence of the solutions that these gatekeepers have been applying and selling to market should concern us all. As it happens, just fortuitously, this week we have started to directly monetize news across all our apps and all our platforms. Now, of course, we monetized it in the broadcast stream, but in the digital space, we also fell foul of the same tolerance levels being applied using independent third-party assessment companies, where news was generally put on a block list for most advertisers because of some algorithmically generated assessment of whether that content was deemed to be brand safe or not. And if you're not monetizing news, you are not monetizing independent journalism, and you are eroding the basis for that functioning democracy. News is so important. And as if we segue from the previous points we're making around the proliferation of AI and the scraping of AI and it being used to determine, you know, or used in a bad acting way, if we don't have quality journalism, then we fall foul of eroding, you know, the fundamentals of this of society.
Do you have the challenge? Have you ever had the challenge in linear broadcasting where advertisers or algorithms will stop advertisers from actually being able to buy on linear news?
Not on linear.
But there's a very
there's a very clear set of guidelines for what ads, what categories go and use. And we have a team that manually assesses the editorial content of the news, the stories that are appearing on news, to ensure that we don't inadvertently create adjacency to stories that are otherwise perceived to be negative or could reflect negatively on the advertiser that is, you know, congruent to that content. So television's been doing this forever. It's important that we monetize. It's really fucking important that news is monetized, that it is funded. And that should extend to all platforms and all domains.
And it's the challenge of news not being effectively monetized, which means that every publisher has to go on the route of trying to find new
content,
ways of being able to generate revenue.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it should concern us all as civilians, not just as industry practitioners, but it should concern us all. The funding of independent news is just, it's bedrock stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Foundational, really, to a lot of things.
This is where we hold power to account. And it costs money. You know, high quality journalism is an expensive engagement. Yeah. You need expertise, and it needs to be well funded.
Yeah, to be done properly, it needs, like you say, absolutely.
There is no News 2.0 solution out there. In fact, if anything, News 2.0 is what we're seeing playing out in the US election now. It's Gen AI,
right?
And that's bad as, you know, nightmarish.
But the problem is, do you feel like you're saying this in a bit of an echo chamber? Because I don't see anybody really disagreeing with this notion. No one's coming out and saying, well, actually, no, news is absolute bollocks. We shouldn't be funding it. We shouldn't be advertising
it.
It's
a default to the algorithm.
Yeah.
It's a default to the algorithm.
It's
where,
not
where
our
news.
Choice.
Football commentary, live commentary or football articles will have the word shot or shoot in it.
Or attack, I think, was an example that I saw somewhere as well.
There's a number of, you know, and therefore negative connotations, right? And the way in which the algorithms default to caution around those terms, out of context more often than not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're getting smarter and will be able to determine that it is a football article and therefore this is potentially going on to the allow list rather than the block list. But come on.
Yeah. It was same with Paris. A lot of the Olympics coverage was under-monetized because of the word Paris from the Bataclan being still on antiquated block lists. And we've discussed this on the podcast before, Lindsay.
Yeah,
what is being done about this, do you think? Because we can sit and talk about it and all agree the news is foundational.
But this isn't the answer.
The question also is advertisers, do you know where else your ads are running?
That's also true, yeah.
Right, so what we do is we go, we're definitely not going to be running adjacent to news content that's negative. And like, meanwhile, your ads are being scattergunned everywhere across the internet and the open web. And you won't have a clue.
But it that comes back again, actually, because it's algorithm. There's an AI element here. Algorithm versus human control. As a human, I can control a keyword because that is something I can make sense of.
Yes.
I can make sense of not wanting my ads to appear against anything with the word shot or attack or Paris or whatever. So add that to the block list. But the problem is, block lists get expanded upon. They never actually get audited. So they get expanded upon. So Bataclan was, 9, 10 years ago? And they'll add that. They'll have added that 9, 10 years ago and gone, right, good. That's all sorted.
Nailed
We're saved against Paris now. But then they don't think to go through and check if those keywords are still relevant. And that's at the fault of the brands and the agencies that are kind of working this way. And it's obviously not just block lists. There's lots of other tools and platforms in play that are helping to kind of perpetuate this. But because that's happening, all the tools out here that kind of go, listen, we will look at the context of the page, we'll look at semantics, we'll look at the imagery, we'll be able to do all this stuff. That is kind of operating almost in a vacuum. It's doing that stuff on top of all the other the things that are in place. So they can't do their jobs properly either. So we're in a lose-lose situation where you end up with Bountiful Cow going, We're gonna
do a good thing here, and it is laudable.
It is absolutely.
But it's also a shame, in many respects, that it is laudable.
Yeah,
this should be just table stakes stuff. Yeah.
It's a really fair point, and like you say, well done to Bountiful Cow. It's a really interesting initiative,
but
sad that we've got to the point where an initiative is even needed. Cool. I will move us on to our final story. Netflix is expecting to double its profits this quarter after the streaming service added more than 5 million new subscribers over the summer. After cracking down on password sharing, introducing adverts to its service, and investing billions in live TV, the group declared it had delivered on plans to shore up its business. Obviously, CTV is a huge thing, and obviously, Rhys, you're very much in the broadcast business. In terms of streaming, how strong a pull do you think the ad-funded model is, and how have you seen the industry develop recently?
Well, we'll have all seen the SVOD services pivot quite hard to AVOD across the course of last couple of years. The reality is there's only so much capacity in the SVOD ecosystem. There's only so many subscriptions that households are prepared to pay for, and so for these large global businesses that need to be paying down on their private equity investments or looking for their successful exits or to pay dividends to their shareholders, new sources of revenue need to be established, and ads is just lowest hanging fruit stuff here. Look, I think Netflix has established itself as an essential part of the CTV ecosystem, the television ecosystem, the contemporary television ecosystem in the UK over the course of the last few years, really accelerated through that COVID period as we all binged on as anything we could get our hands on to deflect from reality. And Netflix certainly capitalised on that. I think that the challenge for Netflix will be how they are able to continue to fill in the top of the funnel. Is their reach curve, if you like, for their subscribers, whether it's advertising or paying, premium paying customers, what is the cost per acquisition model looking like for them, either in terms of marketing and promotions, does it get people to sign up, or what new content do they need to commission that will attract new viewers, new subscribers? And that's a really difficult game, that is. It's just in a business that is as well established and well distributed as Netflix. How do you create programming content models that have high frequency of repeat visits, high frequency of repeat viewing? How do you establish yourself as a channel brand, if you like, within the households that is on the consideration list for the family on the sofa or whatever?
Yeah. How does ITV compete? Like, how is ITVX? I mean, you had a strong summer in terms of sport. But.
We compete. That is it. We contend for budgets. We contend for audiences. We've obviously, across the course of the last couple of years, really invested in our streaming proposition with ITVX. We've got I'm going to say it unashamedly here, we have the UK's best ad product for video on ITVX, powered by our first party data and everything we're doing with ad labs and innovation and integrated partnerships for the content that exists there. So I think we compete very well. But they are, they are a competitor, but they're also, in many respects, a colleague in the space as well. We have shared values. We produce elsewhere in the ITV forest. We produce a lot of their content. They're a frenemy in that respect. But there's space and enough oxygen in the UK ecosystem for us to coexist happily. But we're frenemies. You know, we have shared values, but we contend and compete for our budgets.
I'm always fascinated by when I hear stories. I don't know much about kind of how that all works with the frenemy type thing. I was fascinated when I hear people sort of not understand that actually there's a lot of ITV content that's produced by BBC, there's a lot of Netflix content produced by ITV, and like everyone is kind of dipping into the same pot and they're kind of going, well, I'll bait this, but people won't watch it on my platform, so I'll give it to you instead.
Yeah, well, it's a commissioning game, isn't it?
I mean, I love it.
The BBC's biggest drama at the moment is an ITV Studios production, Ludwig. You know, those of us sitting in the commercial team going, BBC's taking chunks out of our view, but it's not a bad thing because it's a studios. Oh God, yeah, you know, it's complex. It's a complex world. That I think, you know, if you're in the production and studios businesses, you know, in any entity, you must be pretty happy at the moment because everybody's contending for high value productions. You know, not just Netflix and ourselves, but also Disney and Amazon and all the other businesses that are pivoting to high profile premium video content. What a game to be in.
Exciting time.
And you know who's really winning? The big directors and the big actors. Let's just speculate here for a bit. How much do you think David Tennant's been checking out the last couple of years? I mean, he's done the houses, hasn't he? He's been on every channel, including the streaming. He's on Rivals at the moment.
Yeah, he's on Rivals, exactly.
They're not small. Good, you know, there are small checks that have been cut to secure talent of that caliber. You know, and testament, you know, well done him. You know, I'm not calling him out, but if you are a high profile actor that's got a good canon of work in your portfolio, you're going to be set for life.
But I think what's interesting to me as well is a lot of these high profile actors, especially US actors that have been known forever as film actors, are now having to go into the TV space because that's where the eyeballs really are. Like for me personally, I'm speaking about personally because my attention span's just gone bizarre thanks to streaming. I can't watch a film now because if it's not got like some sort of cliffhanger every 20 minutes, I'm just not interested. Yeah. Like 2.5 hours of a film, I can't watch it. Whereas I can binge 10 episodes or something in no problem at all.
Lindsay, that's a very real and very well-known and acknowledged modern or contemporary phenomena in the way that programming is now commissioned and produced.
Interesting.
Yeah, 45-minute cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Right.
That's all me.
You in for the next step. Right. And it's probably not new. You know, books have, you know, cliffhangers at the end of chapters. Yeah. But that chapterification of television now that entices you to do just one more and just one more. It's a phenomenon that really evolved during the COVID period where people were binging and leaning into that. But you're also right about the big Hollywood actors. I mean, George Clooney and Brad Pitt on Apple TV.
Yeah.
Like, damn. Yeah,
exactly.
No, Gary Oldman and the woman whose name eludes me now.
Scott Thomas. And Slow Horses.
Right. Big names.
Yeah.
Well, streaming first.
You know, that's the Apple model, is to create the best quality TV.
Should we look at Apple's market and just see how they're funding this?
Well, exactly. Well,
this is coming back to the point.
They can afford to buy like every studio out there. So,
This comes back to a big structural change in the way that the entire kind of broadcast and video ecosystem is changing, which is there are a couple of huge $1 trillion market businesses who right now I would describe are at their kind of shits and giggles or FAFO stage of figuring out how to do video. Yeah, but they're $1 trillion businesses. They've got cash to burn. They literally have cash in the bank that they can throw against figuring out how to solve for ad funded video. That's Amazon, that's Apple, that's Google. You know, these businesses are prepared to burn down on capital to figure this out, because when you crack it, right, the television business is still the biggest, large, untapped pool of marketing money that those businesses have yet to make meaningful inroads into.
What I'm interested in, and I'm interested in from your perspective, because obviously ITV is first and foremost a broadcaster. Well, it's at its heart broadcaster, and now going into the kind of streaming platform of ITVX, is the likes of Netflix trying to do live streaming and live TV. And I think the first time I tried it was a Love is Blind reunion, which was an absolute car crash. They're now talking about releasing kind of live chat shows with John Mulaney. And I'm just fascinated by they've cornered the streaming space and now they want to go into the live broadcasting
Life's
space.
Hard.
Yeah, well, Life's they clearly
really
haven't done
hard.
A great job so far.
Yeah, and it's not keeping me awake at night. they're in the FAFO stage of thing, but Netflix pivoting to AVOD and Prime now pivoting, Amazon Prime pivoting to AVOD.
putting breaks in content is actually a real art. It's a real skill. Finding the appropriate editorial moment, the transition between scenes, the transition between narrative or whatever. Finding those moments to put the breaks in is a real skill, and it's something that we've crafted and evolved and become expert in over the course of the last 50, 60 years. Right? So if you're watching Prime now, you're midway through a scene and bang, because, I don't know, some 8-minute timer went off, you know, in Central, went boom, put an ad break in now. So just putting ads in pre-packaged video content that's been consumed on demand is challenging. Figuring out how to do live, that's an entirely new ballgame. Sport's relatively okay, yeah. Right, because it's structured and there are breaks and there's rules around, if you like, in inverted commas, broadcasting rules around how you do monetization of sport, but it's structured, and when your breaks appear, that you know that it, approximately 45 minutes into a football game plus injury time, whatever, there's going to be a break. So you can kind of schedule it in that respect. But chat shows in reality, they ain't done it. You know, as live chat shows, they ain't done it. And you know, they've been in the content game 5, 6, 7 years now, and they've still not figured out how they are able to effectively do live.
They might cut their teeth on sport. This might be their way of working out.
Sport's different from a, you know, we are big on, you know, magazine shows. You know, you look at our output from 7 a.m. through till midday.
Absolutely.
Right, that's a real craft, and that's a real industry. And the way that we do that, I think, is world leading. Likewise, a lot of the US networks do it. But cracking that code and figuring out how to do it if you're a streaming native business, it's different. Mm. There's a lot of overhead that's involved as well.
So interesting.
Yeah. And you very quickly get moving. If you're doing that, what regulatory regime you're operating under? That's a broadcast code, right? If you're putting stuff out live, you're a broadcaster.
Well, that then makes it almost impossible, surely, to operate cross borders if you're trying to do that, because that doesn't exist yet,
multiple jurisdictions. Yeah. Yeah. There are a whole bunch of rules for live on broadcast content, you know, that we adhere to, a bunch of regulatory oversight entities that we have to be sure that we're operating within.
Because I have thought of that with Netflix and product placement, and obviously we have very strict rules around HFSS in this country, yeah, which is high fat, salt, sugar, to those who aren't aware. And then you watch something on Netflix and you can see Coca-Cola being advertised on McDonald's, and you're like, well, hang on a second, that's not allowed in this country, so how's that, how are you getting away with that?
Yeah.
So there's a minefield's coming up, I feel like.
Yeah, coming back to where we started, I guess, that it's going to be the effort to retrofit a regulatory regime to streamers who are already well and truly gone, you know, past those points. You know, the doors are open and swinging in the wind, and the horse is well and truly bolted. Yeah.
Great way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a shit metaphor, but we'll run with it.
It's one of my favourites, and it's so apt to cross our industry all the time.
It's always catch up. Regulators are always playing catch up. Yeah. Because, as we discussed right at the very beginning, it's just Wild West out there.
It is. Things move too far for them to keep up with.
Yeah. Mm. And by the time you've managed to create a definition of something, that thing itself, that thing is moved on.
Yeah.
Almost, you know, it's to a point where it's abstracted from the thing you defined in the first instance. I think the regulatory process needs to speed up. Generally, but I don't know how you do that. It's bureaucratic, isn't it? And it's legal, and there's, you know, considerations.
And it applies across every single industry. I was watching something about some Netflix, funnily enough, documentary a few years ago about cloning, and they were saying, well, the problem with cloning is, like, the technology that enables cloning is way too fast for us to be able to grasp before we can create laws around it. And so, you know, an industry, any industry, every regulator is struggling.
Yeah, I mean, when did they do Dolly? That was in the 90s,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
In the 90s, and here we are, 2024, going, we're figuring out the regulatory framework for cloning.
Okay, slightly worrying.
Yeah, exactly.
The door is open and the sheep has bolted.
The sheep is well and truly gone.
Great. On that point, I will I'll bring us to a close there. Reese, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Just a reminder that not all my views necessarily reflect those of my employer.
It's very important to punctuate that.
And Lindsay, much the same for you.
Oh, loved it. Thank you very much. My views are generally not my own. I've nicked them from somewhere else.
Excellent. Well, thank you all very much for listening, and we'll be back next week.